From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it was a dramatic day of public testimony in the House impeachment inquiry. Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU and a point person on U.S. interaction with Ukraine, telling a House committee that he followed the president's orders on Ukraine, that everyone from the State Department to the White House was in on what he called a quid pro quo between the White House and Ukraine to dig up dirt on the president's political rival.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. As I communicated to the team, I told President Zelensky in advance that assurances to run a fully transparent investigation and turn over every stone were necessary in his call with President Trump.
Let's bring in NPR political reporter Tim Mak. He's on Capitol Hill. And Tim, Ken Starr, who led the investigation of Bill Clinton's impeachment, said on Fox News that this was a bombshell day. Earlier, he'd said it could be a moment when Republican senators walked to the White House, as they did in the Nixon era, meaning, you know, to ask for a resignation. So what is your sense? A bombshell, but how big a bombshell?
Well, we learned a number of very interesting things. Firstly, as you mentioned, Sondland testified there was a quid pro quo. I'm reading from his testimony right now. He said, was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and White House meeting, the answer is yes. So that's him establishing that from his view, from what he knows, and in sworn testimony, there was a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
He also said that they were following the president's orders to work with Rudy Giuliani. He said, we followed the president's orders. He also said, we all understood that if we refused to work with Mr. Giuliani, we would lose an important opportunity to cement relations between the United States and Ukraine. So he basically testified that was at the direction of the president.
Yeah, well,
and as you mentioned earlier, he said everyone was in the loop. They all understood they had to work with Rudy Giuliani, that the president wanted investigations, and that everyone that has been mentioned in this testimony, or most everyone that's been mentioned in the testimony, understood that.
Well, and Sondland said that he and other top officials didn't want to do that. But he said, as former Special Envoy Kurt Volker said yesterday, what he wanted was the right outcome for the U.S. and Ukraine, and that overrode his distaste. Let's listen.
We were faced with a choice. We could abandon the efforts to schedule the White House phone call and a White House visit between Presidents Trump and Zelensky, which was unquestionably in our foreign policy interest, or we could do as President Trump had directed and talk with Rudy. We chose the latter course, not because we liked it, but because it was the only constructive path open to us.
Yeah. So he mentioned a White House meeting. He also talked about his concern that military aid was tied to the investigations. He said he told Vice President Pence and others about that. Pence's chief of staff has already denied this, said that the vice president never discussed investigating the Bidens with Sondland. But all morning, it does appear that Sondland is striking back at people who maybe were throwing him under the bus and saying they didn't know anything about this.
He was trying to say essentially that he was not working alone, right? He brings in Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to show that he had the support of his boss at the State Department. He mentions former Energy Secretary Rick Perry as someone he was working in concert with. And he also mentions Vice President Mike Pence, as you note, although that conversation has been denied by the vice president's chief of staff. So he's essentially trying to say, I was not acting alone. This was not me going rogue. This was something that everyone knew and was in on.
Yeah. Republicans, in response, and Devin Nunes, the ranking member, the first to speak, returned to theories that Ukraine was somehow involved in manipulating the 2016 election, criticizing the whistleblower who triggered the investigation. Let's hear a little bit of Nunes as he used his time.
It's an inconvenient truth that the Democrats don't want to admit. They're operatives that were dirtying up the Trump campaign using Ukrainian sources in 2016. They don't want to get to the bottom of that.
He gave examples like a Ukrainian official who wrote an op-ed disparaging Donald Trump. And there were a lot of people around the world who had questions about Donald Trump. And much of the other things that he insinuated have been discredited. How else are Republicans trying to push back on what some would say has been devastating testimony?
Well, they focused on Sondland's testimony that the president never directly told him that military aid was conditioned on investigations. Like we said, Sondland testified that there was a quid pro quo, but he didn't say that the president directly told him that military aid was conditioned on investigations. Sondland said it became clear to him. He said it was like putting together 2 + 2 = 4, but that the president never made the explicit ask. And Republicans are really picking up on that.
Yeah, well, and the president said during the testimony that he didn't know Sondland very well, which would make it maybe not a good idea for national security that he called him on cell phones when he was in a restaurant in Kiev. So the questions will continue. NPR political reporter Tim Mak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
While Americans were watching the impeachment hearing, voters in Britain were watching the first debate in their election campaign last night. Nearly 7 million people tuned into the clash between Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition Labour Party. Here's Corbyn.
We will build a fairer Britain that cares for all, where wealth and power are shared. The Conservative government is failing. It's failed on the economy, on the climate crisis, the National Health Service, and on Brexit.
And here's Prime Minister Johnson.
There's only one reason why we're having this election. That is that we have a deadlocked parliament that will not deliver Brexit. If you vote for us, we have a deal that is ready to go.
Brexit, of course, is shorthand for the United Kingdom leaving the European Union. The next deadline in that seemingly never-ending process is January 31st. BBC's parliamentary correspondent Sean Curran joins us from London. And Sean, what's your take on the debate from last night?
It was, I think, a big moment in British politics. This was the first time we had had a television debate where we had just the two potential prime ministers going head to head. Whether or not we got a clear winner, I think, is harder to say. Polling that was done immediately after the debate seemed to be fairly evenly split. I'm not sure that we had a big dramatic breakthrough moment where somebody said something that we'll be talking about for years later. But I think one of the big things I would take away from it is this rather strange atmosphere in the television studio. Both leaders were laughed at by the audience during this 1-hour-long debate.
Now, really?
We have a fairly raucous political culture in this country, but it is very unusual to have the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition, the two candidates, both being laughed at.
What do you think that signifies?
Well, it's very hard to read into it because, of course, the television companies go to great lengths to make sure these audiences are balanced. But it perhaps suggests that there is an element of dissatisfaction with both leaders. There's resentment over how long this divorce from the European Union is taking. And perhaps even there's a little bit of resentment over the fact that we are having another election in the middle of winter. The first December election for nearly 100 years, people are being asked to take another decision.
Right, right. You brought up something that I'm curious about. This debate was just Johnson and Corbyn, but there are other parties with candidates running in this election. Why weren't they invited?
Well, it's certainly true that the Liberal Democrats and the SNP, the Scottish National Party, the other parties that are in Parliament, the SNP is the third biggest party in the last Parliament. They wanted to take part and they went to court to see if they could force the broadcasters to include them. But they lost that case on a legal point. For years, the broadcasters have wanted to stage this sort of debate with the focus just on the two people who have the chance to be prime minister. And that is why, on this occasion, they've gone down this route. There will be other debates during the course of this campaign when representatives of all of the parties will take place. And there will be chances, and there are programmes going on all the time where the party leaders are questioned by members of the public and the voters, and those encounters are televised. But I think that for a lot of broadcasters, this has been something they've been trying to get for years and years.
I see. You laid out that wonderful timeline of what's happened thus far. Parliament is deadlocked over Brexit. Isn't it very possible that Parliament will still be deadlocked on December 13th, the day after the election?
Yes, is the short answer. The slightly longer answer is, if Boris Johnson gets a majority and there is a majority Conservative government, then he will be able to make progress on his divorce deal with the European Union. If we are in a similar situation to the one that we had when Parliament broke up just a few weeks ago, where there isn't a clear majority, then yes, it's very hard to see what happens next, and it will depend upon what sort of discussions and debates take place behind closed doors between the different political parties as to what happens next. So this is not a guaranteed way of breaking the logjam or ending the deadlock.
That's BBC's Sean Curran speaking with us from London. Sean, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We're following developments in Washington on the second day of testimony this week. EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland gave what some are calling bombshell testimony to the House Intelligence Committee in impeachment hearings.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Our political strategist joins us now, John Brabender, the Republican strategist. He's in Savannah, Georgia today. Hi, John.
Hello.
And Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Well, and John, thank you to you both. And John, to you especially. I'm wondering if you're down there for the debates tonight, the Democratic debates, and on your phone, we appreciate it. But as you know, Clinton investigator Ken Starr is one of those who's been calling this a bombshell day. That was on Fox News. Sondland saying it's not a secret. Everyone knew there was a quid pro quo, not just for a White House meeting, but for military aid. A continuum of insidiousness, another phrase that came out of today. What would you advise Republicans? What are you thinking?
Well, I think what's really out there is a lot of confusion, because we also had a quote by the exact same witness saying President Trump never told me directly that the aid was tied to any investigation. And so what we're finding is over and over again, we're finding witnesses say, well, this is what I presumed. This is what I inferred from Rudy Giuliani and so forth. And so I really do believe this is going to come down to, do the Democrats have a single witness that said the president directed in no uncertainty that I was to hold up any funding until these investigations took place? And, you know, we have not seen anyone being able to deliver that exact line. And so,
So, again,
it's one of those things where whatever side of the ideological fence you're on, I think you're going to view these witnesses as completely different.
Right. Maria, I want to bring you in here. What do you think about what John is saying, that Sondland gave conflicting testimony as opposed to what he said today publicly?
I think it strains credulity, both what John is saying as well as what Republicans are twisting themselves into knots trying to say, have done so and are still trying to say today, given this bombshell testimony. Look, it's very clear that this president has abused his power. Sondland underscored it today. He kept saying, which one of the things I think is incredibly damning, is that, quote, we followed the president's orders, and that, quote, I followed the directions of the president. There is no ambiguity that there was a quid pro quo here, that he wanted the investigations of Burisma and of Joe Biden if there was ever going to be a release of the military aid and a meeting with the White House. That has become crystal clear today. That is why you even have Ken Starr saying this was bombshell testimony. There's no question it was bombshell testimony. There's also no question that still Republicans are going to bend themselves into continuing knots to see how it's possible for them to defend what has been indefensible on behalf of this president, acting in a corrupt manner, abusing his power, And frankly, because of that, he finds himself in the pickle that he's in.
John, I have to ask you, because we know, we've heard so many people testify about this president, not just in this testimony, but in the Russia investigation, that this is a president who doesn't write things down, who doesn't directly say something, but he tells you what to do nonetheless. And in this case, you had Sondland on phone calls with the president, phone calls in which the president is saying, is the investigation coming? And am I getting the investigation? I just want him to do the right thing. I mean, are you not concerned about today's testimony?
Well, look, but again, we have the same witness who said specifically that he was told there's no quid pro quo. And so,
well, but he amended that testimony.
Yes,
he amended
exactly.
that testimony. He wrote.
He remembered
after he heard
truth.
Other people testify. He completely changed that because he realized mm-hmm. he, the newcomer, was being thrown under the bus.
Yep.
Right. But those are the words he was told directly from the president. And so now what they're saying is, well, maybe when I add up all these things over here that other people, that maybe Rudy Giuliani said or maybe Mike Pompeo, that I'm supposed to come to a completely different conclusion. And I think you can understand why people watching this feels like this is just Republican versus Democrat. I don't know who to believe. I'm hearing a lot of conflicting information. And I think we have to be really careful because oftentimes when a president says something, it can easily be misinterpreted. When Barack Obama said to the Russians, I'm going to be more flexible negotiating missile defense after the election, we wouldn't expect that all of a sudden that the defense secretary would immediately start giving the Russians everything they want. If somebody looked at, you know, there was a witness yesterday that said, when Trump said, I need a favor, that he looked at that as a military man as that was an order. Well, let me ask you this. How many military people give out orders with starting with, I need a favor? And so I think this is very convoluted rhetoric. I think people are going to draw their own conclusions. We hear a lot of conflicting information. End of the day, the Democrats are going to vote exactly how they voted. The Republican vote is going to be the same as it was before. It's going to go to the Senate, and nothing's going to happen there. And we're going to be back to square one.
Yeah, John and Maria, let's listen to President Trump this morning reacting to Sondland's testimony.
I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. This is not a man I know well. Seems like a nice guy, though. But I don't know him well. He was with other candidates. He actually supported other candidates. Not me. Came in late.
Maria, I'm curious from you, hearing him and hearing him say that he doesn't know Sondland well. Many of the cameras were on the impeachment hearings and not on this impromptu chopper talk. Mm-hmm. But what position do you think President Trump is in right now?
A very, very difficult one, a very tenuous one. And he knows it. And he's scared. And what he just said about Ambassador Sondland, who donated $1 million to his inaugural committee and who is someone who has been a big donor to the Republican Party and a huge supporter of Trump, is the beginning of Trump throwing him under the bus because he knows that the testimony that he is giving today is incredibly damning. And what I think that I would say in response to what John just said is that this is actually not incredibly convoluted. On the contrary, this is why it is so hurtful for the president. It's become very clear that witness after witness after witness that we have heard up until today and including today, and testimony after testimony after testimony underscores, reiterates, and actually says that what we have known up until now is the truth. And the one person that we have known that we know exactly what President Trump was thinking is President Trump himself. He said it in the phone call. It's very clear in the transcript. We need to have a favor, though, before he's going to release the military aid.
And John,
anyone who tries to bend over backwards, it just strains credulity.
We need a favor. Did you see anywhere in that transcript? Because this really would be breaking news.
We need a favor, though.
He said, we need a favor before we will release the funds. Did you see that in that transcript?
We need a favor, though, John.
Maria, I'm just wondering, do you think
English understands what that means?
John, I just want to jump in. I mean, just going back to, of course, people who say we need a favor think that that means we need a favor. But when you hear the president say, I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. Does this concern you that the president of the United States doesn't know somebody well and then calls him on cell phones, a national security risk, while he's in a restaurant in Kiev? How can, I mean, the president's not calling me. How can you accept that statement from the president of the United States that he doesn't know Sondland?
This is where I will agree with Maria, and I don't mean to give her a heart attack, that, you know, that Trump should not be doing the play-by-play analysis of this impeachment, you know, in hearings. What he should be doing is simply saying, I'm not going to play this Democrat political game. I'm going to concentrate on the negotiation with China, keeping Iran from becoming a nuclear country, and keeping the economy at the historic levels that we're in, and just umbrella explain what a lot of people believe these are political attacks. I think he actually gets himself into a bigger problem sometimes when he tries to play sort of this analyst about himself, which is what he's doing when he's throwing out and making these comments.
Right. He can't control himself
very well.
John and Maria, I know we could spend the entire time talking about this, but tonight is also the Democratic presidential debate in Atlanta. Who do you guys, very quickly in the little time that we have, do you think is the front runner? Is there even one anymore? Maria, we'll start with you.
Sure. I do still think overall it's Joe Biden. You know, clearly we've seen numbers really switch in Iowa. But overall, the trend in poll after poll, people talk about how vulnerable he might be. And that may very well be the case. And that's why these debates are so important. But I think going into it, Joe Biden is still seen as the front runner. And that's why Trump is so scared of him.
John, and what will you be looking?
I think that's right. But I think the key right now is there's this battle almost between Mayor Pete and Elizabeth Warren as far as who's going to be the alternative to Biden. And I think that's what really tonight is going to be about. The problem Joe Biden has is Democrats like him. They don't love him. And when you get to New Hampshire and you get to Iowa, the first two caucus states and vote in New Hampshire, people want to love the candidate they're voting for. And I don't think Biden's going to win either of those two states. And if that happens, we're going to hit reset and find out what the real deal is.
John Brabender.
Can beat Trump.
John Brabender, the Republican strategist, Maria Cardona, the Democrat. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
This week on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we take you back to 2015, when Asma Jama, a Somali-American woman, was assaulted for speaking Swahili at a restaurant. Tune in to hear how Asma found support from an unlikely source, the sister of the woman who attacked her.
There was an op-ed in the New York Times that got our attention this week. Wildlife researcher and tour company founder Costas Christ pushed back against the idea that flying is bad for the environment. We've been hearing a lot lately about flight shame and the no-fly movement. The Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg generated a lot of buzz in September when she took a sailboat to the UN Climate Summit in New York. Here and Now's transportation analyst Seth Kaplan has been watching the debate. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Tanya.
So we've spoken to you before about how flying accounts for 2.5% of the world's carbon emissions. This is what has spurred some people, particularly in Northern Europe, to come out against flying. But Costas Christ has said this week that flying less could actually harm the environment. What is the argument?
Well, he points out that 2.5%, well, that's a lot of carbon emissions, is a lot less than other sources of emissions, power generation, for example, a lot more. And deforestation is one that he says also causes a lot more, some 20% of emissions. And he says that part of combating that means having these places be meaningful to travelers. So for example, somebody who's, interested in the Amazon because they've been there might be concerned about deforestation there. So basically, he's saying it's not a bad trade-off, that 2.5% of global emissions in exchange for doing something about the 20%.
Yeah, he actually makes this argument. He gives the example of if 1.5 million tourists visit Tanzania last year to see the Serengeti and they paid $60 a person a day for entrance fees, take that revenue away and the area could probably be turned into cattle ranches, which has been shown to emit even more harmful emissions. So does he really have a point here?
Well, there's no question that for Tanzania, just from a business perspective, travel has led to good things in terms of preservation, and it's done so elsewhere, too. The question is how this all nets out, right?
Yeah.
You know, because flying, and he concedes, it is one of the first things he says in the piece, it, absolutely, there's an impact. We're talking about a significant amount of emissions. So it's just difficult to say how exactly the world would look if everybody just stopped flying, if in fact you would be able to compensate for all of that with the environmental benefit of the kinds of things he talks about.
Yeah, a compelling argument. But this article also immediately generated a lot of comments. What's some of the pushback that you're seeing?
Well, some people just saying, look, he's self-interested, right? Of course he would say something like this. He's
a tour guide.
Yeah, I mean, he benefits from travel. And just people sort of making the point that, look, if you want to reduce emissions, reduce emissions. You know, that this is all just sort of a big rationalization. Other people saying, look, if you want an environmental or a cultural experience, you don't have to go halfway around the world to get that. You could just travel closer to home.
Speaking of which, we're coming up on the holiday season, flying over Thanksgiving, a record number of people flying. How crowded, with the few seconds that we have, are the airports going to be?
Nearly 32 million Americans,
yikes,
according to Airlines for America, slated to travel. And that, yes, will be a record. Sunday after Thanksgiving, the busiest day.
Brace yourselves, travelers. That's Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Some key moments now on a crucial day in the ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump. U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland told the House Intelligence Committee that he pressured Ukraine for investigations at President Trump's express direction. Sondland took a central role in the administration's Ukraine policy, unusual for the EU ambassador. Ukraine is not part of the European Union. Many Republicans have argued that only a first-person account could give Democrats grounds to impeach, and Sondland's testimony gets them to that. Let's hear some. In his opening statement, Sondland said he wanted to clarify three key points. He said these had been obscured by noise over the last few days, starting with the fact that President Trump's directives on Ukraine came through his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
First, Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and I worked with Mr. Rudy Giuliani on Ukraine matters at the express direction of the President of the United States. We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt. We all understood that if we refused to work with Mr. Giuliani, we would lose a very important opportunity to cement relations between the United States and Ukraine. So we followed the President's orders. Second, although we disagreed with the need to involve Mr. Giuliani, at the time we did not believe that his role was improper. As I previously testified, if I had known of all of Mr. Giuliani's dealings or his associations with individuals, some of whom are now under criminal indictment, I personally would not have acquiesced to his participation. Still, given what we knew at the time, what we were asked to do did not appear to be wrong. Third, let me say, precisely because we did not think that we were engaging in improper behavior, we made every effort to ensure that the relevant decision makers at the National Security Council and the State Department knew the important details of our efforts. The suggestion that we were engaged in some irregular or rogue diplomacy is absolutely false.
Of course, Democrats are investigating claims that President Trump abused the power of his office to push the Ukrainian president for investigations into Trump's political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, and that the White House withheld military aid to make that happen. Other witnesses have testified to that effect, and Sondland said Trump brought up the subject of investigations with him during a July 26th phone call that Sondland took from Trump in a restaurant in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
While I cannot remember the precise details, again, the White House has not allowed me to see any readouts of that call, And the July 26 call did not strike me as significant at the time. Actually, I would have been more surprised if President Trump had not mentioned investigations, particularly given what we were hearing from Mr. Giuliani about the president's concerns. However, I have no recollection of discussing Vice President Biden or his son on that call or after the call ended. I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election. Mr. Giuliani expressed those requests directly to the Ukrainians, and Mr. Giuliani also expressed those requests directly to us. We all understood that these prerequisites for the White House call and the right White House meeting reflected President Trump's desires and requirements.
And Sondland said it was no secret that those investigations were a prerequisite for a White House visit by the Ukrainian president. And he implicated other members of the Trump administration, recalling an update email he sent nearly a week before President Trump's now famous July 25th phone call with President Zelensky. That letter was addressed to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, and White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, among others. The Democrats' lawyer Daniel Goldman asked Sondland whether nearly $400 million in military aid was also a part of this quid pro quo.
At this point, by the end of August, he knew that the aid had been held up for at least 6 weeks. Is that correct?
I believe I found out through Ambassador Taylor that the aid had been held up around July 18th is when I heard originally.
And even though you searched for reasons, you were never given a credible explanation. Is that right?
That's right.
And no one you spoke to thought that the aid should be held, to your knowledge. Is that right?
I never heard anyone advocate for holding the aid.
And now, by this point, at the end of August, it went public and the Ukrainians knew about it, right?
I believe there was some press reports, you know, presuming or who knows. But I think at that point it became sort of common knowledge that everything might be tied together.
And, in fact, President Zelensky brought it up at that September 1st meeting with Vice President Pence that you were at, right?
I don't know if he brought it up specifically, but asked where the aid was, I think was more, I think he sort of asked, again, very vague recollection, because I don't have a readout of the bilateral meeting, but why don't I have my check, essentially?
And you understood the Ukrainians received no credible explanation, is that right?
I certainly couldn't give them one.
So is this kind of a 2 + 2 = 4 conclusion that you reached?
Pretty much.
Is the only logical conclusion to you that, given all of these factors, that the aid was also a part of this quid pro quo?
Yep.
And Sondland said he mentioned this delay in aid to Vice President Mike Pence. But Steve Castor, the Republicans' lawyer, tried to distance Sondland's testimony from President Trump.
But you testified that Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the president, correct?
That's our understanding, yes.
But how did you know that? Who told you?
Well, when the president says, talk to my personal attorney, and then Mr. Giuliani, as his personal attorney, makes certain requests or demands, we assume it's coming from the president. I'm not testifying that I heard the president tell Mr. Giuliani to tell us, so if that's your question.
Right, but at your deposition, you said the question was at the May 23rd meeting when the president said, go talk to Rudy. You responded, he didn't even say go talk. He said, talk to Rudy. You subsequently said it was sort of like, I don't want to talk about this. So it wasn't an order or a direction to go talk with Mr. Giuliani, correct?
Our conclusion and the conclusion of the three of us was that if we did not talk to Rudy, nothing would move forward on Ukraine.
Okay. And then that was May 23rd, and then you never had any personal communications with Giuliani until August, right?
That's correct.
Castor also questioned whether the freeze on aid was politically motivated.
When again did the Vice President Biden nexus come to your attention?
Very late. Again, I can't recall the exact date the light bulb went on. It could have been as late as once the transcript was out, but it was always Burisma to me, and I didn't know about the connection between Burisma and Biden.
And to the best of your knowledge, you never understood that anyone was asking Ukrainians to investigate U.S. persons, correct?
Ukrainians to investigate U.S. persons?
Right.
No.
Okay.
No.
And just to sort of be clear here, ultimately the aid was lifted on September 11th. There was never any announcement by the Ukrainians about any investigations they were going to do, correct?
Correct.
The Ukrainians never, to your knowledge, started any of these investigations, correct?
Not to my knowledge.
Consequently, these allegations that there was a quid pro quo that had to be enforced before the aid was released, that never came to fruition, right?
I don't believe so.
Just some of U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland's testimony today. We will continue to follow this and other news.
Learn more at geico.com.
It's here now. The American Medical Association has called for a total ban on all e-cigarettes and vaping products that aren't approved by the FDA to help quit smoking. The AMA made the announcement yesterday, citing the ongoing vaping health crisis that has injured 2,100 people and killed more than 40. Some cities and states have already banned some vaping products that are popular with children, but these moves don't always help kids who are already addicted. Kavita Cardoza with member station WAMU visits Fairfax County, Virginia, to look at how the school system there is trying to address the problem.
Last year, a 15-year-old freshman in a Fairfax high school was offered a Juul, a flavored vaping product popular with young people. We're not using his name to protect his privacy. He was curious about the buzz he'd heard about, so he said, okay. Soon after, he got caught.
I got one day suspension and had to go to like a class about vaping. And a month of no sports or after school activities.
All of this came as a shock to his mother, Gail, who didn't know much about vaping. Gail grounded her son. Then a few months later, he was pulled out of class and searched. He had a Juul in his pocket.
And when I started to find first the little pieces of the device, the pods and the batteries, I didn't recognize what it was.
This time he was given a 2-day suspension and a year with no after-school activities. No Friday night football games, no trying out for the baseball team. He tried to stop.
And then I got nicotine withdrawals, like a headache and like sweating and like fidgeting. Then like I would call my mom and I'd be like, can you pick me up? I don't feel good. And I didn't really care about doing stuff at that point. I was just like, well, I'm already in trouble. I Juul, like I'm addicted. What's the point?
Gail had to accept her son had a serious problem.
It was nothing I could do. The school took a punishment-only approach. He was spiraling downward into depression and anger. He was isolated, and so he was using more. The punishment was just driving him into a mental health crisis and not stopping his addiction.
That's when Gail realized how little help there is for kids who are already addicted to e-cigarettes, and she's pushed the PTA and Fairfax school system to focus on the problem. Vaping among kids has skyrocketed, says Dr. Karen Wilson, who heads the American Academy of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. She says the latest research shows almost 27% of teenagers have used e-cigarettes in the past month. Adding to the problem, vaping can deliver more nicotine faster than cigarettes. And many kids don't realize just how addictive that nicotine can be.
All of the kids who are current users of electronic cigarettes probably need some kind of help to quit.
So when a child brings a vaping device to school even after having been caught, Wilson says it's likely they're not being defiant, but that they can't stop.
Teenagers are saying that they're so addicted they have to wake up in the middle of the night to use these products. They can't go more than 2 hours.
Wilson says the medical community has also been slow to respond. That's because there isn't a lot known about the long-term health effects of vaping on developing bodies and brains, or how to address this kind of addiction in young people. For example, the nicotine patch is one of the most common therapies for adults trying to quit cigarettes. But it isn't yet FDA approved for teens younger than 18, so many pediatricians won't prescribe them for kids. Jane Miscavige represents all PTAs in Fairfax County, more than 40,000 parents.
It is a huge, huge problem. It is all around us. It is insidious and invisible, and most parents are completely oblivious.
Miscavige says raising awareness of the dangers of vaping and treatment options will be their number one priority this year. Fairfax County Public Schools is now changing how they deal with vaping, moving from a punitive-only response to recognizing vaping as a health concern. Stefan Moskal oversees wellness initiatives and says 3 years ago they saw about 70 students. The next year?
That number jumped to more than 400 because of the explosion of vaping. Last year we provided more than 600.
In response, his office has shifted from scared straight style presentations by lawyers and police officers to information and addiction support. They plan to have 17 substance abuse specialists rotating between schools who'll connect parents to actual people who can help, including outpatient counseling sessions and a support group.
Fairfax has certainly moved in the direction of recognizing that there are students who are involved with something and they need support, and that we have a certain responsibility to provide as much support as we can. The move to supporting students, I think, is absolutely critical.
While Fairfax is trying to help students that were previously overlooked, it's unclear how the school system will cope with the growing demand. For Here and Now, I'm Kavita Cardoza in Washington.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.